Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Margaret Cho, whose latest book is I Have Chosen to Stay and Fight. Margaret Cho is a well-known comedian and activist. She has a DVD of her latest series of concerts titled Assassin, and you can pick it up at your DVD store. Margaret Cho, when I went to your website, I noticed you have a blog. What is the relationship between this book and the blog?
Well, actually, a lot of what I've written comes from my blog. A lot of the things that I talk about, and this happens in my stand-up comedy, too, is that I kind of start off with the blog. That's sort of where everything begins in terms of my writing. And from there, you know, jokes get formed and ideas get more fully formed in my shows. And then so a lot of this raw material is very appropriate for this book and wound up in this book.
Is that the process that you always did? You just kind of wrote like almost like a diary type thing and then just saw what came out and shaped it?
I sort of wrote that way for a little bit, and then I kind of spent more time just writing little pieces of paper, like little words on pieces of paper, so that they would just refer to all these different, like, longer ideas. So having a blog actually makes it much more organized for me, because then I have one place to put everything.
If you're doing a stand-up routine and it has a name, is it the same show that you're going to be doing? What is the variation from show to show?
It's about like an hour and a half jokes that haven't been told before and won't be told again.
Really?
Yeah.
So every show you do is completely different?
Completely different. It's an hour and a half of jokes that are new and will be thrown out as soon as I'm done.
You sometimes sit there and watch these things and go, God, I was good. I'm funny.
Yeah, because I totally forget exactly what I've done. And, you know, there have been so many, there's like four films now, so it's just kind of surprising that I came up with all those things. I'm like, wow, that's great.
So in other words, we can just choose topics from this book or not from this book, and you'll just go riff on them.
Yes, I guess so.
Oh, because I wrote down a whole bunch of topics, and I'm just curious, Margaret Cho, about your opinion about them. You make it very clear that you're sick and tired of this Asian stuff in your book. Because,
yes.
You know, hey, you're a person, you're American.
Yes, I know, and it's hard to come to terms with. And being Asian and being American, because the identity of Asians in our culture is so much about foreignness. Like with the Harajuku girls, this is my latest thing. Because Harajuku girls, I like Gwen Stefani a lot. I think she's a really fine singer and just sort of a great kind of rock icon. And so she now has these Harajuku girls who, they're four girls who follow her around, and they're Japanese, and they're supposed to be from the Harajuku district of Tokyo, and they're very fashionable and cute, and they're dancers. They're great dancers. There's a lot of controversy over them, because are they or are they not some kind of minstrel show? Are they or are they not stereotypical caricatures of, you know, that are sort of playing as accessories to Gwen Stefani and that she's bought all these girls and that you can buy Asian women to stand behind you? And I have all these mixed emotions about it. You know, what should I support this? Should I lash out against it? I don't know, because I'm just so sick and tired of being angry about not being represented properly as an Asian American, and so I just decided to join them. So now I'm going to be one of the Harajuku girls. They all have names like Music and Angel, so I'm going to be Bloated. My name is Bloated. I am the Fist Harajuku girl.
I guess the reason why I ask about that is because we don't get someone saying anymore, hey, you're a woman. Give me a woman's perspective of you're white.
I know.
You know.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Even these days, you're black. I mean, because there's so many black comedians and pundits out there.
Yeah, we have a kind of good take on that experience because it's out there in the mainstream. But when it comes to Asian Americans, it's seemingly acceptable to ask about that experience because we don't see it. You know, we don't see it out there. So it is kept in a kind of foreign idea, like that we're still foreign, and so to me it's hard to really understand my own existence and place in America, and I know that a lot of Asians feel the same way.
Well, I also wonder when the only Asian American pundit out there is the god awful Michelle Malkin. For one thing, your background is Korean American, and hers is Filipino American. The cultures are different to begin with.
Yes, they are very different. But also the experience of Asian Americans now in my generation and Michelle Malkin's generation here is actually much more similar.
So you can look at her and puke as one of your own.
Yes. Well, I'm actually, you know, I talk about her in the book.
Yeah,
and
right.
I'm very proud of her because we've come so far as Asian Americans to finally produce a bigot. you know, that's a great, great thing that we have somebody that is just as horribly wrong and ridiculous and like ill-informed just as bad as like the conservatives. So she's great.
But there aren't any positive role models either, except you.
Well, yeah, I suppose. There's just nobody out there that's really kind of exclaiming, kind of pointing out all of these problems of Asian American identity. So I'm glad to do it, but it is a weird thing. It gets a little bit tiresome, too.
Well, let's move away from the whole Asian American thing, and let's talk about you, Margaret Cho's take on some recent issues that are not in your book.
Okay.
George Bush went through this thing of nominating this woman, Harriet Myers, and then for reasons that are still obscure, the extreme right rejected her. And then he nominated this vile judge named Alito. What's your take on all this?
Well, I kind of think that the whole Harriet Myers thing was a ruse, that he knew that the Republicans were not going to react well to her. Who knows why they didn't like her? I don't really understand what it was, like that she didn't have as strong a take on or she couldn't be relied upon to bring forth, like, you know, an overturn of Roe v. Wade. I'm not sure what their thinking was, but I think that it was a strange way to appease the left, in a sense, because he brought forth a woman and nobody wanted her, so he just got to pick whoever he wants. And Alito was always going to be his choice anyway.
You think?
Yeah. So that's what I think happened. And also, it's so sick. I mean, I'm not over Roberts yet. Like, I'm not over the fact that John Roberts is there. I'm not over John Bolton. Any of the people that he appoints, I'm never over. I can't believe it. It's not enough for him to do a bad job. He has to appoint people to do badly, too. So it's also like a strange thing where this is all going on at the same time the indictments are happening. It's a very, very, very difficult time for the Republican Party. So anything is a good smokescreen, I suppose. You know, the conservatives are so wily. They always try to find their way out of things. You know, like the whole Katrina thing. After Hurricane Katrina, they kept saying, well, this is not the time to talk about this. This is not the time to talk about this, knowing full well that it would go away, knowing full well that all the rage and fear about the fact that the government did nothing to help these people for 5 days would somehow just get lost in the shuffle.
Well, it would, because, you know, Gore Vidal once said this was the United States of amnesia.
Yes.
Everything does get forgotten after a week.
Yeah.
You know, they complain now that we're tired of Libby. I mean, what? He was on stage for 3 days. We're tired of him. Cats ran 10 years.
Exactly. Libby's not enough, and Libby's just a patsy, I think. And he's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, I won't be satisfied unless, you know, Karl Rove is indicted. But I don't know if that'll ever happen, that slippery Vaseline queen Karl Rove.
One thing that Molly Ivins stressed, I talked to her about 3 or 4 years ago about this, is she said we have to avoid hating Bush because it isn't Bush that's the problem, it's the policies.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that?
Well, that's absolutely right. Bush himself is probably likely not to be completely an evil person. He is just part of this system that has just been warped, and it is the policies. And it's this idea that we have the right to do what we're doing to the world, that we have the right to go in and take all of the oil in the Middle East, that we have the right to kind of bulldoze all of, like, real, like, honesty and values and go for greed, you know, that's just these like, overriding ideas that, you know, this kind of weird American superiority that we have to just get rid of that, but we somehow can't. And so it's those ideas, those kind of policies that are really the worst thing.
Margaret Cho, several months ago we had the whole Terri Schiavo story. How did you work that into your act?
I was just really appalled by the whole Terri Schiavo thing, just because here were all of these pro-lifers going on and on about the sanctity of life when they could care less about the fact that there were still soldiers in Iraq dying every day. And here they were up in arms over one life, which, of course, it's a tragic thing, this life, but it is also tragic that so many people are dying for a cause that is not even worthy of it. It's this strange, like, blindness to their own hypocrisy, the refusal to see it. That's really what I was after, you know, in working it into my own stand-up.
When you work something into your own stand-up, you said you kind of feel through the jokes.
Mm-hmm.
How do you go about doing that? What's going on in your mind?
I think it's really about what the audience wants to hear and trying to figure out exactly all the things in the spectrum of things that have to do with a topic, like what does the audience want to hear, and they kind of find it. So I'm like a pig with looking through the ground for truffles. Like I try to find what it exactly is. And I think with the Terry Schiavo thing, it was just they wanted to have that hypocrisy pointed out. It's just about finding the right, that kind of kernel of truth that summarizes all of it.
Are you paying a lot of attention to whether they're giggling and, you know, what that's going on too?
Yeah, and laughing, and or if this is a good reaction, is, oh, that's like always a good sign that you've sort of hit on something that you should keep going there.
What happens when you, like, mention the name Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Arnold is great because Arnold is so easy to make fun of, you know, like things that he says, like, we need to block up boulders and keep the foreigners out, which is just poetry, you know, because of the fact that he is who he is. I mean, where did you come from all of a sudden that you're, you know, trying to kick foreigners out of the country? He's a great person to make fun of because he's like this overblown movie star, and he's a totally, you know, incomprehensibly bad politician. He's just so bad at it, you know, and he's just out of his league because he's not able to shoot anybody or, you know, go into the future and fix it. So it's just he's an easy target and an enjoyable one.
Did you ever meet him?
You know, I've never met him. I actually have a lot of things to say to him because there's so many different things going on that I actually need to deal with him about, because he really is, as California governor, he is our politician. So we have to kind of ask him for stuff. So I'm constantly writing him to grant clemency to Stanley Tukey Williams, who's on death row in San Quentin right now and is due to be executed on December 13th. So I'm constantly begging for clemency for people like him or Kevin Cooper. It's always writing to Arnold Schwarzenegger about the gay marriage bill, and please don't veto it.
So you wrote directly to him about that?
Yes, yes. You know, I write to him, and he's in my email address book. He's probably one of the people I write to the most of all the elected officials that I write to, probably him. He's the highest up that I've spoke to.
And you don't feel it's going into some kind of black hole or German hole or whatever?
Or Austrian hole. Of course
it
is.
Austrian hole, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going in. And it's because I never get a response other than maybe I should buy a book, that grand book about California that's coming out. But it's really distressing because I feel like he's not listening to anybody and doesn't care. And he doesn't care about anything except possibly running for president, which is...
Well, he can't.
I know, he can't do that.
He can't.
But I have this feeling that he's really kind of towing a Republican line, a hard conservative line, in order to let them bend the rules or something.
Margaret Cho, you were born and raised here in San Francisco area,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right.
And when you were about 10 years old, and you talk about it in your book, I've Chosen to Stay and Fight, the whole Milk Moscone thing happened about like 3 weeks after Jonestown. And
yes.
You were just a little kid living in the city.
Yes.
What was your reaction at that time? Do you remember?
I remember that the Harvey Milk assassination really shook me, really a lot, because I had been a fan of his, and it was so shocking that somebody could be killed because he was gay and that his life was actually over because of his activism. And that was something that was so terrible. I had to do something about it. I said, you know, very clearly to myself, I said, this cannot happen. This cannot be. So at that point, I really started to become involved mentally anyway in politics. And as I got older, I would go to events like Rock Against Reagan. They would have these big, like, things, these big things, like kind of south of Market, and they'd have all these bands play. And, you know, I just knew that I was always going to be involved somehow in caring about politics and wanting to, I couldn't wait to vote and I couldn't wait to get involved somehow. And so being a stand-up comic was great because it allowed me an immediate sort of platform for what I wanted to do. Although I didn't really know how to talk about politics right away. That kind of actually filtered into my work much later. But I was doing things like, you know, going and raising money for AIDS and things of a political nature within just also like my stand-up career. So it was extremely satisfying.
What made you get up on stage that very first time?
You know, I don't know. I don't know. I knew that it was the right thing to do.
Had you been cracking jokes among your friends and stuff? Yeah.
No, not really. I was never that person. I was never the class clown or anything like that. It was just something that made sense to me. You know, I just knew that I could do it. I knew that I had the ability, and I knew that it would be my life. I'm glad I was right about it.
How long did it take you before you moved to L.A.?
It took a little while. I didn't really move anywhere. I didn't really live anywhere for a while because I was like driving back and forth, and I was driving all over the country, and I was just kind of very nomadic for many years. I guess I started going to Los Angeles in the early 90s, very like 90, 91, and I didn't really settle there until like 93 or 4, but it's hard to say because I was just so all over the place.
And at that point, you were a lesbian.
Yeah, I was. Well, I was really a lesbian in 1989, like really hardcore lesbian.
Like for 1 year.
Yeah, and then I sort of fell out of love. I thought, I'm not going to do that anymore. And then, you know, like I've always been very open about sexuality and gender and very fluid. And so it wouldn't be fair to say that I'm a lesbian because that's not the only experience that I can say would define me, because I've had so many other experiences. So I guess it would just be like, I'm just queer.
Whoever you're sleeping with.
Yeah, just queer, no matter what.
And you moved down to L.A. and lived in a house where Janine Garofalo lived?
Yes, and also Greg Behrendt lived. He wrote the book He's Just Not That Into. He was also one of our roommates. And Jack Black bought the house a little bit later on. So that was a kind of a very famous address.
So the whole bunch of you were getting started at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Who clicked first?
I don't know. I think probably Janine. Janine was the first one to really start to get a lot of attention because she was doing the Ben Stiller show, and that was something that was kind of like a little bit of, you know, her, like our peer group, a little bit of an extension of our peer group. And all of the comics that I hung out with at that time, like David Cross and Bob Odenkirk. So it's weird. I mean, it's strange because I never see any of these comedians anymore. You know, you get to a point in your life and then you just don't see any of your peers because you're all kind of doing completely different things.
Then at some point, you got this chance to be on this TV show called All-American Girl.
Yes, yes. So it was very exciting. I mean, most of my time I'd spent on the road anyway, and so I was thrilled to come back to Hollywood and be able to work and have like this regular job. You know, it was really terrible because I really wanted the show to succeed, and I felt like I had to do this for Asian representation out there, that I had this responsibility to make this happen because I was going to be the only one that was going to do it. And so it was really a tremendous amount of pressure to put on somebody, and I didn't really know how to act, and I didn't know how to act under that pressure. And so the show didn't work for a number of reasons, but mostly because I couldn't really understand how to make it work. And so it's too bad.
Did you have any input in the show? I mean, would you just hand it a script and then you could just go barf? Or
yes. I mean, yeah, basically. I mean, they handed me a script and they were trying to make it work with me. And the thing is that I think what it boiled down to was that the network was so aware of the fact that we were an Asian American family. They thought that that was such an outlaw idea that they had to make the comedy in the show as banal and boring as possible to offset the shock of these Asian faces. So that was my understanding of what was happening. And I didn't really know how to get around it. I don't know how to fix that kind of writing, how to make that kind of writing better, because it is so about lessening the blow of who we are ethnically, who we are racially, which could possibly be considered so out there. So that whole idea is so odd to me that I couldn't even understand where to begin.
You know, in listening to some of your monologues, I remember from that era, you would talk about your mother. She was a very funny stereotype, but how do you translate that into a sitcom
right. Without
it looking racist?
It is hard because there's this consciousness about political correctness that actually works against the real idea of political correctness, because when you're saying, okay, then I'm not able to present my mother as she is because somebody would consider that racist, me actually doing a voice that sounds like an Asian person. But does that mean that I can't tell the truth about who I am? Like, I can't tell stories from my life and speak as my mother actually does speak because I will somehow be politically incorrect in doing so. So that's like a weird thing. That's just such a strange, strange thing. And I think that is, again, a symptom of the invisibility of Asian Americans in society, that we have no voice. And once we do have a voice, people are so offended and shocked by that voice that they have to stamp it out as soon as possible. So I think that's what happens when we get out there, because there's so rarely ever does.
But I wonder if it's just Asian Americans. You look at a program, say, like Will and Grace, and you see the same kind of pressures. Will doesn't have sex. Mm-hmm. Jack is a stereotype.
Right.
I mean, it is a difficulty.
Yeah. You're basically using these shows to ease people into the experience of multiculturalism. Well, I don't know why they have to be eased into it, but I suppose that's the idea. I don't know.
Margaret Cho, you mentioned something in your book, I Have Chosen to Stay and Fight, that my mother mentioned to me about 2 years ago. This was the period when Martha Stewart was, you know, in handcuffs being carted away. And my mother said, it's because women aren't allowed to be nasty if they're successful. And she also mentioned Leona Helmsley in the same regard.
Right. Well, that's very true. Because if we are successful, we should be gracious and glad about it and not angry and not bitchy and not vindictive and not we should just be kind and loving and nurturing towards everybody else and everybody that works for us. And I think Martha was just being punished for her very strong personality. You know, although, of course, if she had been a man, she would never have gone to jail ever. And she would never have had, like, any kind of interruption in her career path.
Do you sometimes feel as if somebody could be gunning for you at some point?
It's possible. I mean, I don't know. To me, I feel like I'm pretty protected because of my smallness, the kind of I feel like what I do is very insignificant in the big scheme of things, the mainstream. So it's like that's like my obscurity is a good cover. My identity is so rare. The fact that we don't see a lot of Asians out there, the fact that we don't see a lot of women out there doing what I do, it protects me. My oddity protects me.
Does it sometimes surprise you that even after you came on the scene, which is now 15 years, we haven't seen any other equally successful Asian comedian?
Yes, it's odd to me. It's depressing to me. It's sad to me. I think that there needs to be more. There's a great guy named Rex Navarrete. He's very funny. He's Filipino-American. He's coming up. He's doing very well, playing huge venues. And it's really encouraging because he's somebody that I know that I think is very funny. That's not enough. There's nobody else. It's just really distressing. And I just want to encourage people to try and do it and hope that would make it happen, but who knows?
You've also been in films. Mm-hmm. What's that experience like?
It's great. I mean, I like making movies. You know, I've done, like, a lot of work in different kinds of movies and done really little things in huge movies. And I just started my own film that I produced. And, you know, it's a very satisfying thing to do that. I made a film called Bam Bam and Celeste, and it's really exciting. I love the movie, and I want to make more. It's a story about these two kids who leave their hometown, and they go to New York to be on a reality television show. And it's so funny and so dear. And so I'm really happy, and we got to have great people in it, like Alan Cumming and Kathy Najimy. And it's something that I want to continue to do. My director, Lorene Machado, who I've worked with for years, who directed all of my concert films, and she's somebody that I've been very close to for a long time and somebody I collaborated with for a long time. She was the director, and so I produced. So I felt very safe with her because I knew that it would just work out exactly the way I wanted it to. And so starring in it and producing it and having written it, it was just great to see this world come to life.
So what's the status of it now?
It's really like doing well in festivals right now. We're playing at the AFI Festival. We're just at the Toronto Film Festival, and so it'll probably sort of see a theatrical run sometime next year.
Did you have any input on the editing or anything like that?
Yes, which is very hard to go back and pull things out. And I had to pull out some performances of actors that I really, really love because they just didn't work in the film. And, you know, that's really heartbreaking when you have to let go of things just for, you know, trying to keep it down, keep the time down, and try to make it the right length. And it's just a weird process when I would rather keep everything.
Margaret Cho, do you ever feel like you need to reinvent yourself like Madonna did?
I don't know, because what I do is so based on a personality that is very vocal, and it's like the process of reinvention has more to do, I think, with image. And certainly image is important to a degree, but it's not as much as, say, somebody like Madonna, where image is kind of everything. So I still have to keep talking about it. And she's reinvented herself, but she hasn't reinvented herself like, you know, the way that she's speaking about issues and her opinions.
Have you met her?
I've never met Madonna, although somebody said that this girl that looks like me said that she, Madonna sent her a bottle of wine one time at a table, and she took it saying thank you, but and saying she was me.
What if you got an invitation to the White House? Would you go?
No, but, you know, I do. I have. Dick Cheney loved to send me invitations to different fundraisers, Republican fundraisers, and dinners, black tie dinners. And
really?
Where Clint Black is the headliner, and they're $10,000 a plate, and I get the invitations, and, you know, I just want to mark the card and send it back, like, as if. You know, I never, ever would do that. It's because when you've been to the White House, I've been to state dinner during the Clinton administration.
Right.
So when you've been there, you sort of keep getting invitations because they want you to go back at some point. Even now, it's pretty weird.
What was it like going to the White House then?
Oh, it's great. They give you this weird thing where you can't be with your date. So they give you, like, they send you to a table. So they give you, like, a number so you have to sit next to.
You can't be with your date?
No, so you get separated.
Really?
So everybody can talk. So you have to sit with Sumner Redstone. You can't go. Say your date is Madeleine Albright. You can't sit with Madeleine. You have to sit with, you know, whoever else is going to be there. So.
And what do you talk about?
Conversation very stilted. And they don't serve a lot of carbs. They have, like, very delicious food, but it's just very, like, a little bit of phyllo dough. Nothing serious. And no bread basket.
No bread basket at the White House.
No.
I guess because then Clinton would have filled up.
Yeah. Yeah.
You get a chance to talk to him?
No, not at all. I have been able to talk to Hillary sometimes. Like, I've seen her on occasion, actually socially, a couple of times. And she's wonderful. She's a wonderful person, really, really smart and really engaging and, you know, a really good politician. I really like her.
Also, you talk a lot about these dichotomies of ugly and pretty and skinny and fat.
Yes.
Are we a looks-obsessed society even more than other societies, do you think?
I don't know if we're more than other societies, but of course, we are an incredibly looks-obsessed society. And the problem with that is that we also internalize those obsessions. So we end up kind of becoming very self-destructive in doing that. And especially women who are already at a disadvantage in society because of the fact that we're women and we have to deal with sexism and all this stuff, that we really get the worst of it. And so it's just about kind of overcoming all of those obsessions and being stronger about it. That's what something that I'm trying to encourage to happen, because I've just been trapped in that whole thing too.
You said at one point that you'd gone on diets and all of that, and finally you said, to heck with it, I'm just going to eat.
Yeah.
And you didn't put on any weight.
No. It was weird, actually. I actually lost quite a lot because removing the diet consciousness from my life really made me have a different attitude towards food and eating and nurturing myself. And it became a lot easier. And it became so much less urgent to do. It's a weird thing that women do to ourselves. We really get obsessed with weight and looks, and yet once we let go of those obsessions, it's almost like they become totally like the opposite thing. So I'm amazingly free from all that.
Do you exercise a lot?
Yes, I'm a belly dancer, and I belly dance in Middle Eastern restaurants sometimes, and, you know, I really love it. You know, it's this really amazing passion, and I have this great, great friend. She's an amazing dancer and probably the best in the world, Suhaila Salimpour, and she's a teacher here in the Bay Area, and she has a school here, and, you know, it's a tremendous thing in my life. I really love dancing, and I love it because it gives women freedom in their bodies that you've never seen before, and it really is this miraculous thing, because in our society, we don't have that kind of freedom, and we're not encouraged to have that kind of freedom. We have no way to find that freedom. So, in a sense, Suhaila is like this great emancipator for women in their bodies. It's really an incredible thing.
And any woman could do it. How about men?
Men can do it, too. I want to, like, bring women to it because it's this thing that's really helped me in a way that I know would help so many women. And men could definitely benefit from it. But it's, like, such a women thing, too.
You're the generation after mine. My generation flopped. We gave the world George W. Bush.
Yeah.
What do you see about your generation, Generation X, or the one after you?
I love Generation X, and I love the one after us. I think that we haven't yet formed our identity. I think that the baby boomers were so, so strong in doing that and really claiming the world for their own. But we haven't done it yet because we're kind of in their shadow. It's like we have so much potential. We are a generation that's just like waiting to be born still and find out who we are. There's so many incredible changes in society, too. We have the internet now. We have like created this whole universe. That's our generation right there. Is like creating this whole new world to actually communicate and use. And so we're just kind of stretching out, like expanding and seeing what's to come and who we are.
And what about the one after you?
Well, they're going to be the ones that have to save the world from the rest of us.
Margaret Cho, where do you see your career going?
I don't know. I really enjoy all of the things that I get to do, writing and performing. And I'm really looking forward to being a producer and doing that, bringing things to life like my film or television or other movies. This is a great thing. So, and it's relatively new. So that's what I'd like to focus on, I think.
How about more acting?
I'm doing a television show on Fox, which will be the second Asian American family on TV. I'm actually playing my mother this time. So
what's the story behind this?
Well, in my film, I actually play my mother. In my film, Bam Bam and Celeste, I play my mother, and it was a really good thing. It was very funny, and it really made sense, and it worked out really well. So my mother's character actually got herself a development deal to do a TV show. So I'm developing it, and I'll be writing it and starring in it and producing it. So this will be a sitcom next fall.
On Fox?
On Fox.
Apparently, I guess Fox, that part of Fox is very different than
yeah,
the other part
it
of
seems,
Fox.
It seems to be that's the case. So I'm glad for that, which is great.
Have you ever been on Fox News?
I have. You know, I've been on the Bill O'Reilly show.
And what was that like?
It was great. He used to be very nice. And he used to be very, kind of not really conservative. He wasn't really sure, I think, what he was yet. This, he had just come off of, what, Hard Copy? And
right.
He had his own show now, and he was just starting. So it was a whole new world for him. He hadn't figured out his own identity yet.
He hadn't become a lying liar.
No. He was great. He was very, very, very kind to me.
Had you been on since then? Or?
No, but I don't think I would be on now. I don't think I would like it.
Finally, your DVD of Assassin.
Mm-hmm.
Did you sit there in the editing booth for days and hours and months pulling that one together?
No.
No?
No, not at all. I didn't. Actually, you know, in my concert films, I don't do any of the editing or any of that. I mean, to me, it's just about doing the performance, and then I'm done. And so all of that gets done after.
You've been listening to an interview with Margaret Cho, whose latest book is a collection of essays, I Have Chosen to Stay and Fight. Assassin is now out on DVD.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.